From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The historian Bettany Hughes says the Greek philosopher Socrates is elusive. He was a man who never wrote down a word, but his ideas have persisted for 2,400 years now. In fact, Hughes says we think the way we do because Socrates thought the way he did. He wandered the streets of Athens in the 5th century BC, debating the essence of what it means to be human. But Athens, of course, turned against him. He was tried and convicted in a religious court of a religious crime, denying the gods and corrupting the youth. Bettany Hughes is joining us today to talk about some of those questions Socrates asked, questions she says that are more pertinent now than ever, like, what is the right way to live? Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. You can donate $10 right now by texting KUER to 85944. That's KUER to 85944. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It was a fellow writer who gave Bettany Hughes the perfect way of describing the subject she had been working on, Socrates. He called it a donut subject, gloriously rich with a whacking hole in the middle where the central character should be. Hughes says the idea of Socrates, his pursuit of meaning, of the unexamined life, is immensely influential, but even after 2,400 years, but pretty much everything we know about him is hearsay, written by friends or rivals. But in her remarkable book about Socrates and ancient Athens, she attempts to fill that hole, to craft a vivid sketch of the man. And not just the idea part. She points out in the book she's an historian, not a philosopher, so this is also about the setting, the time, and the people who turn against Socrates and sentence him to drink the hemlock cup. That's the name of the book, The Hemlock Cup, Socrates, Athens, and the Search for the Good Life. And Bettany Hughes is joining us today to talk about it. Bettany Hughes is an historian, an author, a broadcaster. She's written and produced documentaries for the BBC, for PBS, for National Geographic, and others. And she's joining us today from the studios of the BBC in London. And Bettany Hughes, welcome. Thanks very much for doing this.
Very lovely to be speaking to you.
Well, I guess I wanted to, what was it, one thing you write in the book is that over the years, it seems like you had noticed that Socrates, as you put it, had been tidied up. The smell of sweat and blood, even the fried fish you said that he ate, had been kind of scrubbed off him. When did you notice that? And when did you decide you wanted to really sort of find a real picture for the man?
I think two things, really, that when we think about Socrates, the image that probably immediately springs to everybody's mind is the idea of this greybeard philosopher wafting around in the Greek equivalent of a toga, thinking high and lofty thoughts. I asked my two teenage children, what do they think Socrates looked like? And that was exactly how they described him. And yet, of course, Socrates was a man who lived this robust, exciting, vivid, very visceral life in Athens at one of the most exciting times in Athenian history for a full 70 years. He was born in 469 BC. He died in 399 BC. So there just seemed to be a bit of fundamental maths there to me that we have this, as I said, this kind of false image, really, of him kept in time, sort of frozen at the moment of his old age. But this was a man who had lived and breathed for 70 years. And then there were really two other things that made me want to, as you say, stop this kind of tidying up of Socrates. One is that when we think of Socrates, I think we often think of his trial and his death. But of course, that happens at the end of a very long life. And the one thing that Socrates was determined we should all do is to enjoy the living of our own lives. So it seemed to me that had Socrates been alive today, he'd be rather perturbed by the fact that we just concentrate on his trial and, right. And this rather sad fact of his death. So I kind of hoped that across 25 centuries I was doing something that Socrates wanted to do. And then just, as you say, I'm not a philosopher. I've got a deep interest in philosophy, but I'm a historian. So I think you cannot understand a man and his mind, a man and his ideas, unless you go back to basics, really, and you try to paint a picture of the world that he lived in. You try to breathe the air that he breathed, stand under the sky that he stood under, and then there's a chance that we might begin to be able to start to paint a more honest picture of this individual.
How difficult was it to trace this story? I mean, especially a man, as we said, he didn't write down a word. I mean, we have the writings of others, Plato, Aristophanes. And I suppose you can trust what they have to say. I mean, you do mention that downright lies wouldn't have washed. I mean, they were contemporaries of him. But I guess that does make it a bit more tricky to try to find the real man.
It certainly does, and I'm very pleased you mentioned that the donut analogy that I do mention in the book, because when this author said to me he's this donut subject, I kind of felt the smile freeze on my mouth, and as I was typing away for 10 years had this kind of spectral donut hovering over my shoulder, because you're absolutely right, you know, in many ways he's an anti-biographical subject. Normally if you're writing a biography of somebody, you pick ideally a person that most people have heard of, and I think we have that with Socrates, but you also tend to pick somebody about whom very little has been written, and yet in the 24 centuries since Socrates died, there hasn't been a single decade in human history when he's gone off the radar. So Socrates has been much written of, much spoken about, much ink has been spilled trying to get to the bottom of his story. And the third thing that you want to do if you're writing a biography is to be able to say, oh, it's fantastic, you know, I found a new secret cache of letters, you know, we have the truth of the man at long last. And I'd love to be able to tell you that was the case, but I, with my hand on my heart, I can't say that. We still, as far as we know, do not have a single word that was directly written down by Socrates. He had a kind of allergy to the written word. But what we do have, and this was really the thing that made me feel it was possible to embark on this rather hubristic task of writing a new biography of Socrates, is that we do have archaeology on our side. Socrates spent many of his years in Athens. He talks about Athens as being the equivalent of his soul, and the Athenians around him were his north, his south, his east, his west. And there's been an enormous amount of archaeological work in Athens, partly because of the digging of a new metro system of underground trains there, partly because of the Olympics in 2004. So actually we can start to jigsaw puzzle together the story of Socrates. And I remember an artist saying to me, if you want to achieve the truest image of anybody, don't paint that person, start by painting that which you find around the whole. And then once you have a kind of Socrates-shaped space, then you can start to fill in the details. So that's what really was my method. That's what I was trying to do.
Give us a sense of the setting then of 5th century Athens, because much of this, as you say, happened in the Agora at Athens. This was the marketplace, and I'm trying to imagine it as a place thick with religious fervor, you say. So there's this greasy smoke in the air, and it was really bustling. Give us a sense of what it would have been like.
Well, I mean, firstly, what an amazing place to be in. People often say to me, you know, as a historian, is there one moment you'd have liked to travel back to in time? And I think it probably would have been 5th century Greece. I think I'd have visited both Athens and Sparta to try to get a little taste of those two city-states. I mean, but what a time. We now describe this as Athens' golden age. What happened at this time is often talked about as the Greek miracle. And although those are kind of, in some ways, big, unhelpful umbrella titles, that there is also a kernel of truth in them, because this was a time when extraordinary things were happening in the city of Athens. So we're talking about the 5th century BC. Mm-hmm. Athens is just a kind of little city state. It's no great shakes. It's not a world ruler. You know, Pericles hasn't done his bit yet. Mm. But what Athens has done is it's shaken off the Persian yoke. So it's managed to pull together Greece and to prove that the Persians could be beaten, which would have been extraordinary for the ancient world, because the Persians were this vast empire of extraordinary military might. And really, Athens was just a kind of annoying little gnat, you know, at their borders. But somehow, Athens had managed to, together with the other Greeks, to turn them back. And I think this gives the Athenians at the time of Socrates a really remarkable sense that they are a can-do society, almost that anything is possible because they've managed to defeat the undefeatable. So what can they do next? So I think, first of all, when we think of Athens at the time of Socrates' life, we have to think of this febrile and exciting place. Again, I think you quite rightly talk about the kind of smells and the tastes of the city, because when we think of Athens, we tend to imagine these kind of bleached, rather elegant marble columns, and again, people sort of drifting around in a genteel way. And it would absolutely not have been like that. Apart from anything else, these great marble monuments, the buildings and the statues that were created would have been painted in these fairground, bright, jaunty, rather garish colours. There's a particular paint that they used to paint the statues of humans, and the sort of flesh colour was this horrible, ugly sort of boiled salmon pink. You know, so you have these garish statues. You have all a very cosmopolitan society, men and women from all walks of life, from all regions, joining together. Athens has become like a kind of magnet at this time. And in order to create a civilization, you have to physically make a civilization. So the air would have been filled with the smell of religious sacrifice, certainly, because everybody, we think probably each Athenian would have made some kind of religious prayer or offering about 15 to 20 times in the day, you know. So this was a place where the gods and goddesses and spirits were everywhere. So you have religious, the smoke from a religious sacrifice, but also you had the smoke from an industrial production of all those beautiful Greek statues that we now see in our museums and kind of marble at. I mean, these things were being knocked out, not quite 10 a penny, but, you know, almost. There was a huge production, a production line of these statues. For instance, there's a place that they were made right at the foot of the Acropolis rock, just beneath that beautiful Parthenon temple. So had you been in the Agora, you'd have had the sounds of the beating of hammers ringing in your ears. You'd have had the scent of the smelting of iron in your nostrils, and you'd have been brushing off the smuts from the industrial production of these Bronze Age statues. So I think it's very important to head shift when you're thinking of Socrates, as I said, to kind of lose from your mind this notion of a calm, highfalutin place. You have to think of Athens as a visceral, vigorous city, and Socrates slap bang at the heart of that.
Mm. And I guess noisy too. You say that the Athenians were used to bellowing.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, very noisy. If you kind of look at the Athenian playwrights very carefully, there's lots of descriptions of the noises that there would have been in these cities. There's a beautiful little fragment that's just been discovered in a wonderful library in Oxford. There's this amazing thing called the Oxyrhynchus Papyri Collection. It's one of my favourite places in the world, and it's in the back rooms of the Sackler Library in Oxford. And you go in, and there are a million or so papyri fragments there, which were discovered just over 100 years ago. They were discovered in Egypt, and they were brought back by a certain Grenfell and Hunt, two kind of archaeologist chums, who brought them back from Egypt in biscuit tins and old kerosene cans. And some of these papyrus fragments, which date back 2,000 years, are still in the original Huntley and Palmer biscuit tins that they were originally collected in. Really amazing. But in one of these, only discovered a few years ago, is this new fragment of a play by Sophocles. And in it, Sophocles describes the incredible sound of a city preparing for war. And Athens went to war 1 year in every two, so this would have been absolutely appropriate for Athens. He describes the sound of the weavers weaving these new cloaks for the warriors, the shuttle's song he talks about the kind of swish of horsehair helmets and the sound of weapons being sharpened. So there would have been a very industrial sound there. Also, as you say, crucially important, the democracy, the first direct, explicit democracy, called a democracy, would have functioned through the shouting, through acclamations. There was a thing called the thoroboss, this sort of noise and mutter and murmur of democratic discussion. So yes, I think it would have been a very, very noisy place. So lots of human noise during the day and just dogs barking endlessly at night.
I want to get to Socrates' early life, but I'm trying to get a sense of him as an older man, because you mentioned some of the reports that he comes across as alarmingly unpredictable, is how you put it, sort of leaping out at passersby and startling them with these moral challenges and these questions. He could be a pretty annoying as a character.
I think really annoying. I mean, I think he'd be one of those people that if you went to a dinner party and you were sat next to him, he'd be like a kind of really smart, slightly enigmatic barrister, and you'd have a great chat at first, and then you'd realise that this guy was constantly tripping you up and picking holes in your arguments and kind of proving really what a fool you were. Oh, no, I think he was very, very annoying. Obviously, also with a kind of magnetic charisma, because, of course, we mustn't forget that Socrates was allowed to philosophize pretty much freely in the city of Athens for almost half a century, for almost 50 years. So even though he was annoying, he was allowed still to continue. But genius is a word that's often overused. And I do think this was a man really with the mind of a genius, because he gets to the critical heart of the question of how we should live and what it is to be human. That there's this kind of rather brilliant description when he rejects the study of phusis, which actually wasn't physics back then in the 5th century. It was more sort of discussion and discovery of nature and a study of nature. And he says, you know, what's the point of travelling to the ends of the earth and of cataloguing the world if you don't comprehend it? He really wanted to get to the fundamental essence of humanity by asking these questions. What is virtue? What is it to be good? What is happiness? Which are questions which actually, if you think about them, are very, very unsettling, interesting to debate. But if you're being asked them as a direct question, firstly, you can easily look a fool. And secondly, you might be rather perturbed by the answers and the conclusions that those around you are coming up with. So I think he definitely wasn't a comforting presence. He actually describes himself as a gadfly, a kind of gnat who's been sent to sting and needle at the hide of this great thoroughbred horse that is Athens. And I think, you know, Socrates, the gnat is something that an image again that we should have in our minds rather than the image of this rather kind of languid philosopher, which is how we often think of him.
What kind of a sight was he? I mean, barefoot, we know, not terribly put together, famously ugly, I guess is fair to say as well.
Yeah, somebody he didn't like baths. We're told he wasn't very keen on personal hygiene. That was all a bit kind of boring, you know, and if you can be thinking great thoughts, much better to do that than to bother to wash yourself. Interesting. Lots of the descriptions of him concur. So I think this isn't something which has been made up by later historians. We're told that he had a rather strange kind of gambling gait, that he kind of lurched a bit from side to side, that his eyes were set very far on the side of his head, that they kind of swiveled in a strange way, that he had this bulbous nose. So he certainly wasn't an oil painting. And actually, although we shouldn't judge him on that, it is critical to remember that, because this was a time in Athens when actually appearance did matter. where beauty was thought to be a gift of the gods. So if you were beautiful, you were actually thought to be somehow blessed, you know, that the gods had decided to bestow this on you. And there's a very interesting Greek word, which is kalokagathia, which was applied to men, only to men, I have to say, not to women. But if men were thought to be beautiful and handsome, kalos is the Greek word, they were also agathos, which means good. So with your outward beauty came a kind of inward beauty of mind and spirit. So for that reason as well, Socrates would have been troubling to people because they would have thought he was the opposite. He was not quite cursed, you know, but not a favourite of the gods because he hadn't been blessed with physical beauty. The kind of athlete's body was thought to be terribly important as well, again, because it was a gift of the gods, but also it proved that you were ready to fight for your city-state and defend it if you had this rather beautiful, oiled, sleek body. And the male aristocrats of the day probably spent 8 hours or so in the gym every single day. So they really would have been fit. You know, I'm not being kind of flippant here. Socrates would have been surrounded by these beautiful young men. So he was always, it seems to me, always slightly out of kilter with the rest of society, just always slightly at odds with it.
And he had this idiosyncrasy that attracted suspicion. It's that I guess we now understand it as a physical condition, a form of epilepsy.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we're told by a couple of sources that he had these strange episodes where he'd suddenly stand stock still as if he was frozen in a kind of trance. And Socrates himself described this as his daimonion, his inner spirit speaking to him. Clearly, it was a medical condition. The jury is still out on exactly what it was, possibly a form of catalepsy, in fact. But again, this would have been very troubling to those around him because religion and belief and your relationship with the gods and the goddesses and the spirit world was by necessity a very public thing. You know, you didn't have an inner private faith. Your relationship with the gods was very much out there in the open, something that you shared with your neighbours, with your family, with your kith and your kin, with the rest of your city-state, in both these great big huge public city-wide festivals and also these little local festivals, and then also at the tiny shrines where you would go and make offerings with your along with your neighbours. So the notion that you have this inner invisible relationship with some kind of spirit would really have bothered the Athenians. And I do wonder if this is one of the reasons why eventually they decide to call Socrates to the court and to condemn him to death.
Bettany Hughes is with us. She's the author of the book, The Hemlock Cup, Socrates, Athens, and the Search for the Good Life. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the British historian Bettany Hughes is joining us to talk about one of history's most fascinating characters, Socrates. Her book is The Hemlock Cup, Socrates, Athens, and the Search for the Good Life. She's joining us from the studios of the BBC in London. So I wanted to ask you about his early life, Socrates' early life, which you write about. Because one thing I have to say, I was surprised at the amount of time he spent as a soldier, because this is something that you've talked about, that if you imagine what he may have seen on the battlefield, maybe that's the thing that got him thinking about, you know, these deeper questions. And the fact that as an older man, having seen what he's seen, to still consider what it means to live the good life is kind of impressive.
Well, that's a very, very perceptive point, because I think that we all forget that Socrates, well, we forget that he was a living, breathing man. We sort of think of him, you know, as this kind of prototype philosopher almost, but he was a real man. And exactly as you say, he fought, as all Athenian citizens of his age would have done, in the citizen army. We think he probably fought actively in at least 20, maybe even 25 campaigns. And we have physical records of particularly three of those battles that he fought at Amphipolis, at Delion and Potidaea. And exactly as you say, I do wonder whether Socrates' constant and urgent search for the good in life, this is what he tried to understand. What is good, and what is it that makes us good as we are, as humans? I wonder if it's because actually, although he was surrounded by this exciting, vibrant city and, you know, a place where there were many possibilities, he was also surrounded by a lot that was very, very bad. We mustn't forget that as a young boy, he grew up in the southeast of Athens, and he'd have woken up every morning looking out over the Acropolis rock, and he would not have seen the beautiful Parthenon temple that we're all so familiar with today, built by Pericles. For the first 12 or so years of his life, he'd have looked at the war ruins of the archaic temple, which had been burnt to the ground by the Persians. There'd been many attacks, terrible murders there when the Persians arrived. So he grew up with that. He was then, as you say, a soldier for much of his young adult and then middle-aged life. And he saw terrible things on campaign. In the siege of Potidaea, when he was on the outside and they were besieging a city, the siege lasted so long that the inhabitants of Potidaea had to turn to cannibalism. He would have known that. He'd have heard stories of it. He might even have heard the consequences of that. In another of his battles, the Battle of Delion, the bodies were left out to rot on the battlefield for over a week. This was both considered a great kind of pollutant because you were supposed to be able to bury your dead. This was the only way that you would end up loved by the gods. But also, again, just imagine that as a soldier watching your fellow Greeks rotting on the battlefield. So I think we have to include a discussion of his time as a soldier if we're going to understand his philosophy in a more nuanced and sympathetic way. Because I really do think he saw a lot that was terrible, and therefore he thought, how do we as individuals, how do we cope with some of the bad hands that we're dealt with? How can we have a kind of inner strength to live the best life that we can possibly live?
It's hard to imagine, you say, really anyone of Athenian society at the time not having a belief in the gods. And you point out there was no separate word for religion. I mean, it was life. Life itself was thought to be, you point out in the book, a religious experience. So the way the Athenians saw the relationship with the gods, I suppose it, in many ways they saw it as just kind of capricious, that the gods could act on them in whatever whim they want. And you say they believed the world to be fat with threats. Talk a little bit about that, and then how Socrates, I'm not sure if he challenges that idea, but he gives us a contrary view that we can start thinking about things from the inside on our own.
Well, that's absolutely right. I think that really as an ancient Greek, you'd have spent huge amounts of time in your life and in your day desperately trying to keep the gods on side. As you say, there was no separate word for religion because religion was everywhere and in everything. The gods were thought to be all around you, just around every street corner, in every breath of wind, in every apple that ripened on the tree. There was some spirit or god involved in that process. So the idea that there would be somebody who would stand up to the gods in some way would be absolutely petrifying. I mean, not just troubling, but really thought to be a catastrophic in terms of society and its strength and security. And there are all kinds of things that start to happen towards the middle of Socrates' life where I think the Athenians begin to question whether they are doing right by the gods, because the gods seem to be displeased with them. In the Peloponnesian War, which the Athenians fought against Sparta, the two things. One is there's always this question as, was Socrates a bit of a secret Spartan lover? You know, he seemed to admire a lot that the Spartans did. So kind of was he a bit of a double agent in their midst? But also, the Peloponnesian War starts well for the Athenians, but then it starts to go very, very badly. It drags on. It becomes a war of attrition. And in the middle of the 420s BC, when Socrates is right in the middle of his time as a campaigning soldier, he comes back to Athens and this terrible plague has ripped through the city centre. All the Athenians have been encouraged to stay within the city walls with the idea that they can kind of last it out against the Spartans outside. But it looks as though this terrible punishment from the gods has been sent to rip its way through the streets. And Thucydides, the historian, gives us an incredibly vivid account of the effects of this plague. I mean, it's really, you know, it brings me to tears every time I read it, because he writes about it so plangently. He talks about men and women desperate for water, going and stretching out to the fountains, and just mothers, brothers, husbands, sons, wives dying within a day. We know at least 80,000 Athenians were killed at this time. So that means it actually was decimated. It was reduced to a tenth of the size that it was before. And Socrates comes back. He witnesses all of this firsthand. But if you imagine that scenario, and you imagine that you're living in a deeply pious civilization, some would say deeply superstitious, then of course you're going to think that the gods are turning against you, and you're going to start to want to look for scapegoats. And Socrates begins to be mocked in the theatres. Aristophanes writes this incredibly funny but very cruel comedy, really, in which he features, called Clouds, when he says, you know, Socrates is just wasting time. He's going and asking, he's mocking the gods. He's asking these ridiculous questions about what it is to be human. And you can get the sense that these niggling seeds of doubt are being planted in the minds of the Athenians. And as you say, Socrates, although actually, if you look at what Plato writes about Socrates, and I think what Socrates believed himself, he doesn't ever, he's not an atheist.
No.
He doesn't ever say there are no gods. He doesn't actually say you should disrespect the gods. He seems to actually, to me, to have a very respectful attitude towards spirituality. But what he also says is, just think about this. Maybe there's a potential that we aren't just living in the lap of the gods. Maybe through human agency, through filling our own potential as individual human beings, by asserting some kind of moral and ethical code, maybe we can make the world around us better. And although that to us sounds like a very inspiring and empowering thing to say, if you were a 5th century Athenian who had lost half of your family in war and plague and civil strife, actually it would be a very troubling supposition to be dealing with.
I'm trying to imagine, there's a great scene in the book where you sort of imagine Socrates on the front row of that play, Clouds.
Mm-hmm.
And that relationship with the Aristophanes, we don't have to say too much about it, but I, you know, people wonder if in fact he was a critic or that he hated Socrates, but you also get a sense that maybe they were just sort of debating friends, that they had a nice kind of friendly, or at least caustic, maybe, rivalry.
Yeah, I think that's right. Like sort of Christopher Marlowe and Shakespeare, you know, they were both clearly very smart people living in this really what was kind of a pretty small town. We know that they knew each other. We know that they did have debates and conversations. And I think you're right. I think Aristophanes was sort of trying it on when he mocks Socrates. He was almost seeing how far he could go. And of course, this is a city which really is fetishizing freedom at this time. And that both means freedom from slavery, freedom from the Persians, but also freedom of expression. There's this incredibly exciting idea that you can speak freely in the streets. But what hasn't yet been dealt with, and this is an issue that we'll still deal with today and struggle with in civil society, is, does freedom of expression give you freedom to offend? How far can you go when you speak freely of those around you, when you have free opinions? And I think Aristophanes is pushing the boundaries when he talks about Socrates in this way. And I think, you know, there's no doubt that Socrates is pushing the limits really every day of his philosophizing life, and very definitely in his trial when he tries to defend himself at his trial. Mm. But I think I think we can't underestimate really the impact of that play of Aristophanes where Socrates is mocked, because in a way it seems to me this is an example really of early trial by media. That you've put this figure out there, he's suddenly become a figure of fun. You've listened to the roar of the crowd. When suddenly they're not laughing with somebody, they're laughing against them.
Were you surprised how, because you've talked about this, how sympathetic you came to feel for Socrates, that he's kind of a victim of this, of these rumors and this kind of bad PR?
I was very surprised. I thought, you know, I'm a kind of feisty, youngish woman. not that young anymore, but, you know, I like writing women back into history. I like kind of looking at the underdog, and I wasn't expecting really to kind of feel that sort of emotional, personal connection to Socrates. But there's this incredible thing that he says at his trial, which I have absolute sympathy with. And I think actually, you know, all your listeners will very readily be able to connect to that. One of the things he says that in a way, there's no point me defending myself because it's as though I'm boxing against shadows. You've come up with all this slander. You've described to the court all the bad things that I've done, he says to his accusers. And how can I defend myself against these words? Really, really interesting. At this time in Athens, a lot of attention was paid to this goddess called Peitho. Mm. And Peitho was the goddess of persuasion. So she actually had a temple right up on the top of the Acropolis Rock, sort of at the entrance to the Parthenon temple. And Peitho was a tricky goddess. Very interesting, I think, that this notion that actually we can use words to persuade one another to do things which shouldn't really happen. And Peitho also has a kind of sister called Phemé. And Phemé is the ancient Greek word for rumour and slander. And interestingly, Phemé then gives us the Latin word pharma, and then we get it as fame. So I always think it's very interesting when celebrities court fame, actually they should probably know that literally what they're courting is rumour and slander. And Socrates is very acute because he says, you know, you have no defence against rumour. Once an idea is out there, what's important is not what you do, but what people say about what you do. And I think we probably all of us in our individual lives have felt that we've been misjudged, and that gossip, which then becomes malicious gossip, actually sets the tone for our lives rather than truth. And I think there's no doubt that this is something that Socrates suffered in his trial. Just people started to talk about him, mutter, murmur, whisper that bit too much, and he suddenly loses favour towards the end of his life.
One of the other charges, of course, is that he's corrupted the youth. And you write about this in the book, that the youth of the city would often, I mean, he would go and seek them out at in the Agora, and they would often congregate there. And you mention how Athenian society would kind of divide people into these strict age groups. And the youth were seen as having this kind of particular strength. And when you hear about Socrates' interest in the youth, or as it's put, you know, how he had corrupted the youth, it can sound kind of creepy, but you do mention that this wasn't a sexual thing for him. He was really just looking to the youth because he figured they had a lot to learn, I guess.
Absolutely right. I mean, you know, any suggestion that this is salacious is completely wrong. It's much more that you get the sense that Socrates, what is crucial to him is this notion that inquiry and asking questions of the world around you shouldn't be something which is thought to be seditious, but instead is something which should be central to what it is to be human. And who better to encourage to ask questions than those young men who are about to enter the world as fully grown adults? But of course, as any parent knows, you know, I'm a parent of an 18-year-old, and actually I don't necessarily want her to question everything that, you know, I say and to tell me that I've been thinking it all wrong all these years, you know, and what do I mean by this and what is good. So you can imagine how in personal terms, how incredibly annoying this was actually for those Athenian parents, and also worrying because the youth of Athens are their military muscle and might. These are young men who, as I said before, have been training probably for 8 hours a day, each of them, in the gymnasia in order to be literally fighting fit. And these are the men who are then going to have to go out and defend the city-state of Athens against its enemies. So these are men that you do not want to question authority, that you do not want to question the status quo. So I think Socrates' relationship is very troubling, not in any kind of sexual way, but purely because of what he's encouraging them to do. He's encouraging them to open their minds. And of course, the famous aphorism of Socrates is that he said, "The unexamined life is not worth living for a man," which is both extraordinarily exciting a statement, and if you are in authority, quite a troubling one too.
Bettany Hughes is with us. Her book is The Hemlock Cup, Socrates, Athens, and the Search for the Good Life. We'll take another quick break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Bettany Hughes. We're talking about her book, The Hemlock Cup, Socrates, Athens, and the Search for the Good Life. I think it's so interesting how Socrates is summoned or charged for this trial, because you explain there's this summoner, I guess even two of these summoners, and they, in these theatrically loud voices, they announce Socrates' crimes to the world. And not only that, they post this notice about it in these, I guess there are these massive red letters.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's, you know, no internet in those days, so you couldn't get an email saying that you were being summoned to court. So it was something that had to be done very publicly. And this is a very Athenian way of doing things, both that you're sharing this experience with those around you, but also actually, interestingly, that you're using writing to declare that somebody has done wrong. Athens comes to be called the city of words. And in a democracy, words and writing are very important because, of course, you have to publicize the decisions of the democratic assembly, because that's what a democracy is. You're deciding this on behalf of the people. And Socrates, he's very anxious about the written word. And I think there's no little irony that it's in writing that he's summoned to court with these great red letters painted on one of the walls near the Agora. There's a very beautiful passage when Socrates, we're told, said that writing really is like an orphan, that as soon as it goes out into the world, its father isn't there to protect it and to explain exactly what it means. And I think we all feel this. You know, when you've sent an email to somebody and it's been misread and the nuance hasn't been understood, it's exactly that. You know, you sort of wish that you, as the father or mother of that, of those words, you could be there and explain what was going on. And I think, you know, we shouldn't really forget when Socrates talks about this, in a way, he wasn't talking about his own world. He was talking about ours. He could see us coming where there was a real issue with all this written communication. He much preferred face-to-face communication. Mm-hmm. But there we are. He's summoned to court with these, as you said, these shouts from his accusers and these great letters. And I've been to the actual location of his trial down in Athens, in the Agora. Incredible place, really. There's this huge limestone block on which would have been oaths would have been made, and the religious archon who was in charge of the court, because he was taken to trial in a religious court because of this idea that of he'd committed impiety, that he was disregarding the city's gods and inventing these new gods of his own. And again, you sort of got to think about this was a place that was at once very rational and in some ways incredibly superstitious, almost somewhere that was back in the Stone Age. So the man who ran the trial of Socrates, he would have made sacrifice before the trial started. He'd have slit an animal's throat. He'd have collected a bowl of blood. He might even have kind of squashed the testicles of an animal to prove that he was going to start this kind of theatre of business. And it's in this kind of heady, religious atmosphere that Socrates is brought to trial in front of 500 of his fellow Athenians. And these are Athenians, you must remember, who've lived through a dreadful, debilitating war with their arch enemy, Sparta, who've lived through this terrible plague, who've now lived through civil strife, and they really want somebody to blame for all their troubles.
Mm. Well, you point out that it seems like as though there's this... this story is playing out at a time of change, like this kind of golden era or golden age is passing, because most of the greats of Athens are gone. Sophocles and Euripides, the free thinkers, have been sort of exiled or executed. Their work has been... So things are changing, I guess. There's this transformation going on?
I think that's very, very true. I think that Socrates is tolerated at a time when the city is robust enough to deal with questions. But once things have become this fragile, when society is really structured, where the Athenians are not sure about their relationship with the gods anymore, they think that they're no longer blessed, but there's displeasure in the heavens for what the Athenians are doing. Now they just want answers. They don't want questions. And Socrates was the embodiment of a man who asked questions. So, you know, we shouldn't really forget the dark atmosphere, I think, of Athens at this time, where he's being judged by men who, as I say, have suffered terrible personal losses. I mean, this is an absolute certainty, where there's not been enough food in the city for a number of years, and they want to find somebody to blame, I think.
I get a sense that you are a little frustrated in some way with Socrates' behavior at the trial, because he's calm or cool, insouciant, you say, even apathetic. And you say his naivete is kind of distasteful, that he's not really taking this seriously. And I'm not sure if you're frustrated by that, but did you certainly take note of it?
Well, yeah, I think I am frustrated with that, actually, because I think that because it's almost in that moment, I think that you can see Socrates for what he is. Mm. He's this extraordinary thinker. He's a brilliant wordsmith. In many ways, he's a survivor. I mean, he's lasted till the age of 70. He's experienced the golden age of Athens at first hand. And yet, he doesn't have the social skills or sensitivity to read the atmosphere of that courtroom, because I think that he thinks he can just do what he's always done, which is stand up, be extraordinarily clever, charming in his own infuriating way, because he makes this incredible speech where he has to suggest his own punishment. And at this point, really, what you should do in an Athenian courtroom is you should moan and wail and prostrate yourself and scratch your face and declare your humility and that you don't, you know, you don't deserve what the Athenians are going to do for you. And you should really make yourself the most humble and craven of creatures. And Socrates just says there, and he says, OK, you know, this is really interesting. So you're saying, you know, that you're going to condemn me for the way I've treated Athens. Well, I tell you what, how I've treated Athens, all I've ever done is good for the city. So I think actually what my punishment should be is free dinners at the expense of Athens for the rest of my life. And, you know, this is a clever, smart, double think, lateral thing to say. And normally in his atmosphere of the symposium with his aristocratic clever friends around him, there'd have been probably a ripple of applause and, oh, Socrates, you know, he always pushes it too far. But in that courtroom, you almost sense the atmosphere dropping by a number of degrees. And suddenly you have the sense that those 500 men who've come to try him think this man isn't, he's laughing at us. He isn't taking us seriously. We'll show him what we're made of. And there are two votes in his trial. And the first vote comes back with many more wanting to condemn him than had in the first trial. And the suggested punishment is now state-sponsored suicide. It's death by hemlock poisoning.
That's interesting. in the sense that you mentioned the Greeks didn't want, I guess they didn't really want to get their hands dirty. They wanted, they had bloodless crucifixions. They didn't like the idea of all this blood and gore, which seems ironic in the sense if you're trying to imagine this sacrifice that the judge is going to conduct before the trial begins. But they didn't want them to die like that, I suppose.
No, that's right. They didn't want to spill a fellow Athenian's blood. You're absolutely right. Miasma is a word. It was thought to be very miasmic, a kind of polluting thing to do. So actually, technically, they don't condemn Socrates to death. They encourage him to commit state-sponsored suicide. So he's left in his cell. I mean, the terrible, terrible thing, if you actually think about the reality of this situation, is because it's a religious month, and there can be no polluting death at the time. It's a special month when the great and the good of Athens go to the sacred island of Delos to purify themselves. Socrates actually has to sit it out in his prison cell for a month, for 4 weeks, before he can actually commit this state-sponsored suicide. I mean, and that's a long time to sit and wonder whether he should have been quite so smart in the courtroom, you know, whether he should have tried to effect a different outcome for himself. Mm-hmm. But again, the fascinating thing is we're told that he was there, that his friends came to visit him, that some of them try to arrange an mm-hmm. escape for him, that they're going to have this sort of network of aristocrats ready to whisk him away. And Socrates says, no, I'm not going to do this. The laws of Athens have condemned me. Athens, remember, we discussed this right at the beginning, is where he said his soul sat. So he says he's going to sit it out and he's going to allow Athens to do what they will with him.
There's some sense that perhaps after he had been condemned and after he had died, that Athenians felt a sense of remorse, that the city even was going to mourn the old man. Is that what happens?
I think it is. I think pretty quickly. I think he was an extraordinary person. And I think, however irritating they are, those extraordinary people in our lives, we miss them when they're gone. And pretty quickly, as you say, Athens decides to set up an honorific statue to Socrates just outside the city walls, just outside the city gate. So he's not honored within the city. But you think that they probably realize they've made a terrible mistake. And I wonder if just, you know, blood ran too high in that courtroom. Mm-hmm. It was also this month called Thargelion in the Athenian calendar, which is the month of scapegoat sacrifice, where a very, very ancient ritual where a man and woman used to be sent out of the city to sort of kind of almost cleanse the city. And I think they just thought, well, this is great. This is, you know, a perfect coincidence. Socrates will be our scapegoat for this. But of course, this wasn't an ordinary man that they were messing with. And they honour him. And he's still absolutely honoured in Athens today. He's still considered one of the greatest products of that extraordinary Athenian democratic experiment.
Bettany Hughes, her book is The Hemlock Cup, Socrates, Athens, and the Search for the Good Life. Joined us from the studios of the BBC in London. Bettany Hughes, thank you very much for the time.
Absolute pleasure to speak to you. I'm going to go back out into London rain now, so I wish I could carry on talking to you.
Cheers. Thank you.
Thank you.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.